Welcome back to the second hour of the Rob O'Donnell Show here on WILK News Radio, 103.1 FM, 910, 980 AM, or anywhere in the nation on that free Odyssey app. It is 409, 77 degrees on this Thursday, June 26th, 2025. So there's this new book that's been on my nightstand for the past 2 weeks. I've been unable to put it down for the time that I have it there. Crucibles, How Rites of Passage Shape the World's Most Elite Organizations. I'm happy to bring on Rear Admiral James McNeil, and retired Rear Admiral of the United States Navy Supply Corps, currently serving as an adjunct leadership professor and sprint football coach at the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, and J. Eric Smith, former U.S. Navy Supply Corps officer, retired nonprofit executive and management consultant who lives in Sedona, Arizona. Gentlemen, you both with us?
I'm here.
I'm here, Rob.
Thanks, okay,
thanks for
great.
Having us on.
Yep. No.
And thanks for the Rush intro. It's one of Eric's favorite bands, so I don't know if you knew
Indeed.
That. But I know he appreciated that.
Well, that's my normal intro, so I'm a good fan there. So your book, Crucibles, that you both co-wrote, I love the way you went with non-traditional is not the bad word, but we've heard so much about Navy SEALs, Green Berets, Army Rangers, and you would think two military guys, you know, that would be the road they go down. And I know with some other works that you guys have done, you kind of go off the beaten path for these things, and I think that's what's interesting about this book.
Yeah, we're both big fans of a philosopher named Daniel Kahneman. He had a bestseller some years back before he passed away called Thinking Fast and Slow. And his fundamental theme is that the way that people learn best is through storytelling. And I think telling a story that people are familiar with is less interesting and exciting and engaging than finding a story that that supports the message and the information we want to communicate in an engaging way that hopefully is new to people. And we had about 30 candidate crucibles that we were thinking about writing about, and we ended up with 15, and we did start with the SEALs and Green Berets and stuff like that, but we kind of concluded that that story gets told a lot. It's been told well. Let's try to tell one that is a little bit different and maybe something that's not as familiar to people.
Yeah, and as I've dove into this book, I've kind of looked at this book in a non-traditional method because, one of my kids right now is going through one of these crucibles with the U.S. Marines at their TBS school. Being a former organized crime detective in New York City, you know, the mafia was a very – so I've kind of jumped around the chapters here. Jim, tell us a couple of the groups. Tell us the groups that you covered here. You covered about 14, I believe, right?
Yeah, and as Eric said, we had about 30 groups that we looked at, and I like the fact that you saw that these were kind of non-traditional crucible groups to take a look at, because one of the things that I really enjoy, and I think Eric does as well, is we learn a lot by doing this. That a lot of these we didn't know anything about, and by doing the research and the writing, we learn as we're doing the projects. That's one of the really fun things for us. But back to your question, we started off with a very strong chapter about Marines and boot camp. I know your daughter's at TBS right now. We had a great interview with Lieutenant General Lori Reynolds, who's a classmate of ours, who was the first female CO of Parris Island and was the first female to take a Marine unit into combat. So she had an excellent, excellent chapter, and that was one of our. We wanted to lead the book off with that because it's such a strong opening chapter. We did things like the French Foreign Legion, the Gurkhas, the Swiss Guard, like you mentioned, the Mafia, the White Coat ceremony with doctors, the Knights Templar. We had a great interview with Major General Bolden, who's a Naval Academy grad, class of 68, about the astronaut program. And then we went from that to Japanese and the kamikazes. And you don't maybe not think that as an elite organization, but there were definitely things with that that made it unique. So we hope that as people read this, we talk about what are the lessons we can get from these organizations and the crucibles that they have. But we're also hoping that as people read it, it's really interesting from a historical perspective, and we had a lot of fun writing it.
It appears like it, and very informative with the, you know, as much as I've dove into it. Now, Eric, with we've seen these people trying to replicate these crucibles in everyday life. We see it in reality TV with like these Survivor Islands, you know, where they go through this, you know, event together, kind of push themselves to the limit. We have races like Tough Mudders where people kind of push themselves to the limit as a group. So in the end, they could get a little feeling of what this is like. This could be transferred into, you know, corporate life, everyday life, your family life, just someone personally to push themselves to an extreme so they could look back and say, well, you know, look what we went through to get here. And as a group, that just does nothing but bring that bond closer. And that's the gist I get from this.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. You know, what we tried to do is, you know, we framed the book around our own experience of going through plebe year at the Naval Academy. We were classmates there and then classmates at the Naval Supply Corps School. And then we looked at the, you know, 14 other non-Naval Academy things. And at the end of the book, we tried to sort of boil down what are the lessons learned and what makes a successful crucible. And the ones that are the most successful, I would say two things above and beyond all others. One is that the crucible aligns with what it is that you actually are bringing people into your organization for. So if you have a, you know, a brutal physical crucible to bring people in, you know, for a, what's largely a desk job, you're not achieving the goals. And if you have a very, you know, casual crucible and you're bringing people in for something that's a very extreme physical challenge, you're not going to get the people that you want in the organization. And then the second thing is, just as you said, that building of community. I think the biggest takeout for Jim and I, you know, in working on this book and our prior book, Side by Side in Eternity, is really reflecting on, you know, what we took out of our Naval Academy crucible. And a big part of that is the Navy has this concept of links in the chain. You know, when we finished our plebe year, we became links in a chain of every class before us that went through the plebe year experience and every class that followed us that went through the plebe year experience. And in our professional and personal lives in the 40 years since we graduated, you know, those links in the chain have been very valuable, both professionally and personally, just those contacts and connections. And, you know, when we meet other Naval Academy graduates, we may be doing completely different things in our lives at this point, but we share that crucible experience, and it's a very strong uniting bond among all of us.
Now, Jim, being through one of these crucibles, going through plebe summer at the Naval Academy and getting through that and that link in the chain that goes on throughout your lives, is your experience looking at it from the inside at the ones that you researched for this book, is it more of things that are just written in stone and you either do it or you don't, or is it better if it's more fluid and like a living crucible to where it does change with the times, to where it does you know, adapt to a changing everything, a changing world?
Well, yeah, I think it definitely does need to kind of change with the times. And you know, as Eric said, we kind of buttress the book through our plebe summer and plebe year experience. And Rob, I know, you know, you have two kids that went through it. And I would say that, you know, Madison and Gavin's experiences, even though they were relatively close in age, were different. And so I think you do need to kind of change with the times. However, the basics still remain. So there may be some changes due to just, you know, and part of it's society, you know, part of it's, you know, you know, Gen Z is different than baby boomers and millennials. And so it has to change with the people, but you really can't have a crucible that builds a community, as Eric said, if you don't have some consistency. So as much as, you know, the big Naval Academy thing, my dad was class of 62, my dad would say, you know, you didn't have a plebe year. Class of 62 had the last plebe year. After that, it was easy. And that's kind of what every, you know, Naval Academy class says. So everybody has a different experience, but everybody still has that kind of that basic crucible. And it's, I don't think we did this on purpose, but today is induction day, is I Day at the Naval Academy for the class of 2029. So in about an hour and 40 minutes, there, we've got a whole nother class of another link of the chain, as Eric said, that's going to raise their right hand to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. That's exciting.
Eric, with the people that have chosen to do a crucible for whatever the organizations, in the organizations you research, the 30 plus, even the ones that didn't make the book, it's easy to say I want to be a part of something until it's time to be a part of something. Is that demand, is that threshold to get through the crucible and being accepted by the group on the other side of it? Which one of the groups that you research for this book impress you the most throughout history?
Oh boy, that's a tough question, because we really found a lot of them impressive in different ways. I would say of the ones that we actually included in the book, the ones that were the most eye-opening to me were probably the Koa warriors in Hawaii and during the time of King Kamehameha, and their crucible involved being thrown into shark-strewn waters and having to kill a shark, extract its eyeball and eat it, and then they were declared to be great tiger sharks on land. And I think the other one that Jim mentioned earlier that was really eye-opening to me was the Japanese Special Forces in World War II, the kamikazes. The only way that a person can say I was a kamikaze is if they died, crashing their plane into enemy assets. But the crucibles that they had to go through and what those very young people, a lot of them were students, in their teens, what they went through in belief in what their nation stood for was really extraordinary and really poignant. There's a lot of journals that were written by young men, right before they took their terminal flights, and very, very, very powerful. And but all of the crucibles that we talked about, as you said, it's easy to apply for them. It's hard to get through them. And we kind of focused on ones that were, at the particularly hard end of the spectrum. And the best of those are the ones where that portal process was designed and controlled by people who had done it in the past, who knew what it took to do what it was that you were bringing people in. And they were the ones who established the parameters for separating the wheat from the chaff, if you will, and deciding, who was going to be the next member of that community.
Again, we're speaking to James R. McNeil, retired Rear Admiral of the U.S. Navy Supply Corps, currently serving as an adjunct leadership professor and sprint football coach at the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. And J. Eric Smith, a former U.S. Naval Supply Officer, retired nonprofit executive and management consultant who lives in Sedona, Arizona. Crucibles, how formidable rites of passage shape the world's most elite organizations. Jim, what do you want the readers to come away after reading this book with?
Well, as I'd mentioned earlier, I want people to enjoy the book. There's a lot of really interesting historical stuff. So I want people to say, wow, I really, really enjoyed that read. So that's number one. And number two, I think that, and you started off, Rob, by saying, with the SEALs and special forces, and I think that a lot of quote unquote ordinary kind of average people view this stuff. Oh, I could never do that. Hey, I could never do that. Hey, I could never do that. And I think what we show through the book is it's not necessarily extraordinary people that do this. It's people who have the desire to do it. And so hopefully, not only will they get some lessons out of these different crucibles, but understand, hey, I think I could do that. So maybe I am going to try something that I didn't think that I was ready for. And I think if it motivates people in that way, that would be a great result in the book.
Great. And J. Eric Smith, do you want to close out with that, and then we'll tell people where they can get the book?
Sure. I'm happy to let people know where they can get it.
So sure.
Do you want me to answer that same question?
Well, yeah, if you want to answer the same question, and then we'll get to where they can get the book.
Yeah, I agree with Jim that it's all about the concept of learning how a well-designed crucible can allow an ordinary person to do something extraordinary and to become part of an extraordinary organization. And I think that, you know, what we tried to do with the book was to talk about what types of organizations have the best crucibles of that variety, and what organizations, you know, modern businesses, government, the military, you know, what things can organizations do today to build portal processes that deliver them the ordinary people becoming extraordinary to benefit their mission and to make their work and their product better.
All right. And again, the book is Crucibles, How Formidable Rites of Passage Shape the World's Most Elite Organizations. And I see it's here on Amazon and Kindle, hardcover and audio CD. Is there anywhere else that people could get the book? I'm sure at the bookstore at the Naval Academy.
Yep. Bookstore at the Naval Academy. Ask your local bookshop to order them. We've seen them on shelves in different places around the country, but if they're not there at your local bookshop, you know, most bookstores are very happy to order them. It's on Agate Publishing, based in Chicago, a great house that we've been really happy to work with. And you can also go to my website, jericksmith.com, and there's information about both of the books that Jim and I have written over the past few years. And we're already deep into our next project, so we'll look forward to having that one out here in a couple of years.
Yeah, and just to give a shout out to the book before that, which I absolutely loved, was Side by Side in Eternity: The Lives Behind Adjacent American Military Graves, by both you two gentlemen again, James R. McNeil and J. Eric Smith. Gentlemen, I appreciate you joining us today. I'm sorry for the emergency weather interruption, but I appreciate you joining us to tell us about this great book.
We appreciate you having us on. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob.
All right, have a great night. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio. It's the point of the show where we honor our heroes here at home who made the ultimate sacrifice on this day, June 26th. Today we have one, Police Officer Thomas Dowling, Philadelphia Police Department in 1912. Police Officer Thomas Dowling was shot and killed while attempting to arrest a juvenile in a pawn shop on the northeast corner of 5th Street and Vine Street. Officer Dowling had entered the pawn shop to speak to the owner about a recent police notice enumerating certain stolen articles for pawnbrokers to keep an eye out for. As Officer Dowling entered the business, the owner just finished making a phone call to the police station about a juvenile who was attempting to sell him diamonds that he was suspicious of being stolen. As Officer Dowling approached the juvenile after being notified by the owner of his suspicions of the stolen diamonds, he was shot. The suspect fled the scene after the shooting, but was eventually arrested after a short chase involving an officer and several citizens. The 18-year-old suspect was convicted of murder and sentenced to 20 years. On August 20th, 1912, he escaped from Eastern Penitentiary. 5 weeks later, during a sensational gun battle with police in Wilmington, Delaware, he shot and killed himself. Officer Dowling served with the Philadelphia Police Department for 11 months. Again, this was June 26th, 1912. And those are our officers for today. There was a story that I wanted to talk about, and it's one of the reasons I don't care for these types of shows, and what I'm talking about is On Patrol Live. And On Patrol Live recently, a Tennessee sheriff's deputy was beaten into critical condition on live TV show by the suspect he was seeking, where he was hit in the head and face with a brick or a stone. He seemed to be kind of recovering after, though, although being dazed after being dragged out of the woods by his fellow officers. That officer then got very worse, and ended up being in a coma. Now, from what I understand, he is not out of the woods, but he is doing better. There was an update by his sheriff's department, the Knox County Sheriff's Office, where Deputy Dalton Swanger, he was knocked into critical condition by suspect Christopher Hensley in a wooded area in a residential Knoxville neighborhood. Now, this was live on TV, this entire incident. I'm not a fan of these shows, A, because they just create anxiety in me because, you know, I did this for a living. I don't like seeing it. I don't watch police shows. I don't watch shows like that because, you know, I'm at the point of my life where I don't want to watch those types of things anymore. I did it. I don't like the distraction that it is. And I understand reality TV and the public wanting to see what goes on. Listen, pull the body camera footage from all the officers involved and create a show out of that. To put a camera crew in there, you're distracting for many reasons that I'm not going to get into the detail there. I'm thankful that this officer hopefully makes a full recovery. I'm glad he's doing better. There are a couple fundraisers by his department to help him and his family out because he will be out of commission for a while. This was officers responding to a call for a shooting in a neighborhood. Individual was in a dark wooded area, basically yelling threats and expletives at them, and they went in to get him, someone who was possibly armed. Thankfully, they weren't shot, but he was struck in the face and head with a rock or brick, some sort of stone, causing him to go down and unconscious, was dragged out by officers, seemed to kind of start to get his wits about him, but then later collapsed and had to be rushed to the hospital to where he was in a coma for a while. There are improvements, but he still says he has a long road to recovery. So it's one of the reasons I don't like these types of stories. It's 441 here at WILK. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Rob O'Donnell Show on WILK News Radio. We're going to get to Today in History in just a minute, but we do have Luzerne County County Controller yes. Walter Griffin on the exemption for non-wartime veterans.
Hey, how you doing, Rob? First time caller. How you been?
Good. Thanks for calling
in. You're welcome. I just wanted to make a clarification on the reason why that I stood at the podium about this exemption. To be perfectly clear, I am not against the veterans getting this exemption. I think they should get the exemption. My problem is when we, as a county or a government agency, decide that we're going to violate a state law or the Pennsylvania Constitution, we stand on a real slippery slope. And where do we stop with that ability to do that? So my question for the council is, if you're going to do that, why don't we just give every veteran the real estate exemption? We can do that as a county, to your point. If the county wants to say every person who served in the armed forces gets a real estate tax exemption, we could do that as a county. It would be very financially detrimental to the county. But my issue with this particular one was the Constitution says they have to be armed, a conflict, and the Title 51, Chapter 89 also says the same thing. When I spoke to the gentleman in Harrisburg about this issue, I was informed especially emphatically that law says that unless they served in armed conflict, which is dated conflicts according to the statute, certain wars have certain time frames, mm-hmm. that they are not exempt from that real estate tax exemption. And I said, that's fine. And the problem becomes is we can only exempt county taxes. We cannot exempt municipal taxes, and we can't exempt school taxes. So correct. By what council did is we gave them the ability to exempt county taxes only. So some veteran who should be getting the whole thing, county, school, and municipality taxes waived because they're 100% disabled, now can't get that benefit because the legislature doesn't want to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot. And that's my issue, is that the legislature can easily put this on the ballot. I don't think there's a person in the Commonwealth that would vote against this constitutional amendment to change the Constitution to make that say non-wartime veteran. I don't think that would be possible.
But is it a violation of state statute when they're abiding by the letter of the law? They're just expanding on it as a county. And I agree with you. Let's start with just county taxes. And while you take this win for your county residents who are 100% disabled in non-combat or combat, like I've said before, a majority of our men and women in the service are injured and disabled during training accidents, not at times of war.
Oh, and I totally agree with you, Rob, but the statute says under circumstances from the armed forces of the United States for service in any war or armed conflict. That's what it says. It doesn't say non-wartime vet. It says armed conflict.
Well, and the county is abiding by that because you're already giving them that in the letter of the law, but you're expanding as a county, and I don't see how that violates the law. You're adding to it, which you can do. You know,
if they're non-wartime veterans, they don't qualify.
But the county is saying they do within the county.
Well, yeah, because the county, and that's what my point is we're violating what the statute of the law is. They have to apply to the state to get this exemption. and the state says, sorry, you don't meet the criteria to get that exemption. And so now they're able to get it because now the county is now saying that it's okay, we're going to allow it for county taxes. And I'm not saying we can't do that. All I'm saying is that doesn't give them the benefit that they would normally get if they were qualified through the state. And the state needs to fix that statute. I think it's a bad statute. I think the Constitution needs to be amended. And I think it can be done the proper way. And the county doesn't end up getting litigation, because what's a veteran going to do when he goes to his school district and says, hey, I want school tax exemption? And the school district says, sorry, we didn't approve that, and we're not going to approve that. And now, because you know the school tax is double of a county tax, mm-hmm. it's more beneficial for them to get the county the school tax exemption.
Oh, I agree. I agree to have the entire Commonwealth covered under this is the best option.
Sure.
But when Harrisburg passes a law, say a firearms law or anything like that, any law, the county, a municipality can add to that. They just can't go any lower than that. That is the threshold. And you are abiding right. by in the county of that law. Those people are getting that. You're adding to it at the county expense. I don't see that as a violation of law. I think that's the county giving a benefit to these people who deserve it. But you're right. Yes, it should be the entire legislature for all 67 counties. But I would take the win as Luzerne County, portray this to the rest of the Commonwealth that, hey, if you're a veteran, we care about you here in Luzerne County. This is what we did for you. And we're going to start the process to notify our elected officials in Harrisburg to make this statewide. Why don't everybody join with us? And rather than saying we're violating the law and litigation, because I don't think that's the case here. The county can expand on the base floor of the law, which they did. It's not infringing on the states.
I think when you say they expand on the base floor of the law, I think when you are expanding the base floor of the law to go the other way of the law's intention, because the law intention was to give it to them only if they were armed conflict veterans. So when you're extending it to make it something less than that, because you're not armed conflict, even though you're just as worthy, I think that's where the problem becomes. And then the other problem becomes is now you become able to stretch another law. So what are we going to do when a policeman comes and wants the benefit because he's got a disability 100%. He wants to have a real estate tax exemption, and there's no law for that. And we could obviously do that.
Well, in the Commonwealth, there's not. In other states, they do, and that's an attraction for people to go to those states. You know, Maryland being one of them, one of our neighbors to the south. How many other counties expand this now? Do you know offhand? I know there's more. I just couldn't find a number.
About, I think there's from when I spoke to the state. They told me it was like six or seven counties that do it. And I said, well, how do those counties like Lackawanna and Potter and Pike and some of these other counties get away with doing that when clearly you're telling me that that is a violation of the Constitution and the state law? He said, the Commonwealth does not enforce that. We're not an enforcement agency. We're a legislative agency. If you guys want to do something different on your end, you guys certainly can do that. We're telling you that when they apply and they're supposed to apply through that, the way they're supposed to apply to get the exemption is go through the state. If the state says no and we want to say yes, that's okay with the county. What the state is saying, we're not going to come down on you and say we said no and he can't get it. Then it becomes your problem to make sure that if the property is sold between the family member or whatever, then it's your responsibility to make sure that that exemption goes away. If the veteran passes away and the spouse passes away, then it becomes the county's responsibility because he had nothing to do with giving it to you. So it's really, and I said, I don't fault them for giving it to him. I think it's a great thing to do it. I just think that we need to really do a concentrated effort to get these laws fixed for the good of these veterans, because they clearly do deserve that disability benefit, and they should get it. But unfortunately, they won't fix it legislatively.
And again, I get your job being controllers to watch the purse strings of the county. So you're asking valid questions here. Now, I have here application process for this, not this exemption for Luzerne County, but for the whole program statewide. Veterans must apply through the county director of Veterans Affairs.
They apply to the veterans. So they go to the director of Veterans Affairs. The Veterans Affairs director gives them the forms, helps him fill them all out, and then that director of Veterans Affairs shoots that form up to the state. The state reviews the forms, make sure they meet financial criteria, make sure they meet the wartime veteran criteria and all the things that are in the statute, and then they send back a letter to the veteran and to the Department of Veteran Affairs saying, we gave Walter Griffith the ability to have this exemption because he qualifies. Or they send a letter back and say, Mr. Griffith doesn't qualify because he didn't serve during this period of wartime, so we aren't going to allow him to get this exemption. That's the process. And then the assessment board is the one that puts in the abatement in the tax rolls to say, I don't have to pay my taxes. So now what becomes a problem for the county is we have to give an abatement just for county taxes for some veteran. We can't give an abatement for the municipal side, and we can't give an abatement for the county or the school side, only for the county side. So now it becomes a problem. So now they're going to get a tax bill for just the municipal taxes when they get their taxes for real estate taxes. And then the school taxes are going to go out automatically to that veteran, and he's going to have to pay school.
Yes.
And you know what's going to happen is some veteran's going to get a school bill in September and say, I don't have to pay this. I'm exempt.
Or start reaching out to their representative and get movement on the statewide issue in Harrisburg, which
exactly.
would be part of the normal process. Who did you speak with in Harrisburg that gave you this guidance? Yeah, you don't have to give me a specific name if you don't want to, but agency.
It was the Department of Military Affairs in Harrisburg, the agency that gets the applications. I spoke to they call him the adjunct general, who is the high guy who you would appeal your ruling to. You would appeal to the adjunct general. And I spoke to him as well. And he said, you're right, Walter, we have 6 or 7 counties that do it. They have real strict guidelines in their resolutions and policy and procedure to keep track of that. But we can't stop the counties. Counties are independent. If they want to give it to them, that's fine. And I appreciate that idea. However, I just think that when we stand on a place where we can change the spirit and nature of the law just because it's a right thing to do for somebody, then we have a lot of them that we need to fix. The rain tax is one of them. The rain tax.
I'm already on that, Mr. Griffin.
Yeah. So
I've already spoke to the director of the EPA.
Why do we bother? Let's just pass a county law that says all residents of Luzerne County don't have to pay a rain tax.
Well,
it's a state law. We don't have to follow that.
There's some people that have done that. There's some places that have done that. They're getting fined, but what happens with the fine? So,
there's no fine. You know, we should just waive the whole fee. I mean, we can, according to what the premise is here, if the state law says that's what we have to do, that's just the floor. If we want to change it, we can say, okay, well, we're going to give certain people the exemption. So if you have to pay rain tax and you have 3 acres of blacktop or more, you don't have to pay the rain tax.
No, there's counties in the area that don't have it at all. So Luzerne County is one of the ones that did institute it. So a great talk there. I appreciate you calling in, Walter Griffin.
No problem, Rob. I appreciate the time. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you for calling in. I get what he's saying, and I understand as county controller, Walter Griffin's job is to protect the purse strings of the county. I just differ on, I think you take this as a win for Luzerne County. I think they are abiding by the spirit of the law and honoring what the law says. They are expanding it for what they have control over. County taxes only does not count for municipal or school taxes. Yes, I agree that hopefully Harrisburg takes this up and makes it all 67 countywide, and we honor our veterans who've been 100% disabled. Just not in a time of war. So they were training for war. They were still doing the same thing because we train like we fight.